You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 4 in Steiner's Collected Works. It is the Michael Wilson translation of The Philosophy of Freedom, newly revised for the special edition marking the 150th anniversary of Rudolf Steiner's birth, so the paginations are in this new volume, for those of you that have older volumes. This is the second, section I'm reading, and this is Steiner's prefaces. We begin with the preface to the revised edition of 1918. There are two fundamental questions in the life of the human soul, toward which everything to be discussed in this book is directed. One is it possible to find a view of the essential nature of man such as will give us a foundation for everything else that comes to meet us, whether through life experience or through science, which we feel is otherwise not self-supporting and therefore liable to be driven by doubt and criticism into the realm of uncertainty? The other question is this: is man entitled to claim for himself freedom of will? Or is freedom a mere illusion, begotten of his inability to recognize the threads of necessity on which his will, like any natural event, depends? It is no artificial tissue of theories that provokes this question. In a certain mood, it presents itself quite naturally to the human soul. And one may well feel that if the soul has not at some time found itself faced in utmost seriousness by the problem of free will or necessity, it will not have reached its full stature. This book is intended to show that the experiences which the second problem causes man's soul to undergo depend upon the position he is able to take up toward the first problem. An attempt is made to prove that there is a view of the nature of man's being which can support the rest of knowledge, and further, that this view completely justifies the idea of free will, provided only that we have first discovered that region of the soul in which free will can unfold itself. The view to which we here refer is one which, once gained, is capable of becoming part and parcel of the very life of the soul itself. The answer given to the two problems will not be of the purely theoretical sort, which, once mastered, may be carried about as a conviction preserved by memory. Such an answer would, for the whole manner of thinking on which the book is based, be no real answer at all. The book will not give a ready-made, self-contained answer of this sort, but will point to a field of experience in which man's inner soul activity supplies a living answer to these questions at every moment that he needs one. Whoever has once discovered the region of the soul where these questions unfold will find that the very contemplation of this region gives him all that he needs for the solution of the two problems. With the knowledge thus acquired, he may then, as desire or destiny impels him, adventure further into the breadths and depths of this enigmatical life of ours. Thus it would appear that a kind of knowledge which proves its justification and validity by its own inner life as well as by the kinship of its own life with the whole life of the human soul, does in fact exist. This is how I thought about the content of this book when I first wrote it down 25 years ago. Today, once again, I have to set down similar sentences if I am to characterize the main ideas of the book. At the original writing, I limited myself to saying no more than was in the strictest sense connected with the two fundamental questions which I have outlined. If anyone should be astonished at not finding in this book any reference to that region of the world of spiritual experience described in my later writings, I would ask him to bear in mind that it was not my purpose at that time to set down the results of spiritual research, but first to lay the foundations on which such results can rest. The philosophy of freedom does not contain any results of this sort, any more than it contains special results of the natural sciences. But what it does contain is, in my judgment, absolutely necessary for anyone who seeks a secure foundation for such knowledge. What I have said in this book may be acceptable even to some who, for reasons of their own, refuse to have anything to do with the results of my researches into the spiritual realm. But anyone who feels drawn toward the results of these spiritual researches may well appreciate the importance of what I was here trying to do. It is this: to show that open-minded consideration simply of the two questions I have indicated, which are fundamental for every kind of knowledge, leads to the view that man lives in the midst of a genuine spiritual world. In this book, the attempt is made to show that a knowledge of the spirit realm before entering upon actual spiritual experience is fully justified. The course of this demonstration is so conducted that for anyone who is able and willing to enter into these arguments, it is never necessary, in order to accept them, to cast furtive glances at the experiences which my later writings have shown to be relevant. Thus it seems to me that in one sense this book occupies a position completely independent of my writings on actual spiritual scientific matters. Yet, in another sense, it is most intimately connected with them. These considerations have moved me now, after a lapse of 25 years, to republish the contents of this book practically unaltered in all essentials. I have, however, made additions of some length to a number of chapters. The misunderstandings of my argument, which I have met, seemed to make these more detailed elaborations necessary. Changes of text have been made only where it appeared to me that I had said clumsily what I meant to say a quarter of a century ago. Only ill will could find in these changes occasion to suggest that I have changed my fundamental conviction. For many years my book has been out of print, in spite of the fact, which is apparent from what I have just said, that my utterances of 25 years ago about these problems still seem to me just as relevant today. I hesitated a long time about the completion of this revised edition. Again and again I have asked myself whether I ought not, at this point or that, to define my position toward the numerous philosophical views which have been put forward since the publication of the first edition. Yet my preoccupation in recent years with researches into the purely spiritual realm prevented me from doing this in the way I could have wished. However, a survey of the philosophical literature of the present day, as thorough as I could make it, has convinced me that such a critical discussion, tempting though it would be in itself, would be out of place in the context of this book. All that it seemed to me necessary to say about recent philosophical tendencies, from the point of view of the philosophy of freedom, may be found in the second volume of my title, Riddles of Philosophy. Rudolf Steiner, April 1918. Preface to the first edition, 1894, revised 1918. In the following is reproduced in all essentials what stood as a preface in the first edition of this book. Since it shows the mood of thought out of which I wrote this book 25 years ago, rather than having any direct bearing on its contents, I include it here as an appendix. I do not want to omit it altogether, because the opinion keeps cropping up that I need to suppress some of my earlier writings on account of my later ones on spiritual science. Only the very first introductory sentences of this preface, in the first edition, have been altogether omitted here, because today they seem to me quite irrelevant. But the rest of what was said seems to me necessary even today, in spite of, indeed just because of, the natural scientific manner of thinking of our contemporaries. Our age can only accept truth from the depths of human nature. Of Schiller's two well-known paths, it is the second that will mostly be chosen at the present time. Quote, "Truth seek we both, thou in the life without thee and around, I in the heart within. By both can truth alike be found. The healthy eye can through the world the great Creator track. The healthy heart is but the glass which gives creation back." Close quote. Translation by E. Bulwer Lytton. A truth which comes to us from outside always bears the stamp of uncertainty. We can believe only what appears to each one of us in our own hearts as truth. Only the truth can give us assurance in developing our individual powers. Whoever is tortured by doubts finds his powers lamed. In a world full of riddles, he can find no goal for his creative energies. We no longer want merely to believe. We want to know. Belief demands the acceptance of truths which we do not fully comprehend. But things we do not fully comprehend are repugnant to the individual element in us, which wants to experience everything in the depths of its inner being. The only knowledge which satisfies us is one which is subject to no external standards, but springs from the inner life of the personality. Again, we do not want any knowledge of the kind that has become frozen once and for all into rigid academic rules, preserved in encyclopedias valid for all time. Each of us claims the right to start from the facts that lie nearest to hand, from his own immediate experiences, and thence to ascend to a knowledge of the whole universe. We strive after certainty in knowledge, but each in his own way. Our scientific doctrines, too, should no longer be formulated as if we were unconditionally compelled to accept them. None of us would wish to give a scientific work a title like Fichte's, "A Pellucid Account for the General Public Concerning the Real Nature of the Newest Philosophy," an attempt to compel the readers to understand. End title. Today, nobody should be compelled to understand. From anyone who is not driven to a certain view by his own individual needs, we demand no acknowledgement or agreement. Even with the immature human being, the child, we do not nowadays cram knowledge into it, but we try to develop its capacities so that it will no longer need to be compelled to understand, but will want to understand. I am under no illusion about these characteristics of my time. I know how much the tendency prevails to make things impersonal and stereotyped. But I know equally well that many of my contemporaries try to order their lives in the kind of way I have indicated. To them I would dedicate this book. It is not meant to give the only possible path to the truth, but is meant to describe the path taken by one for whom truth is the main concern. The book leads at first into somewhat abstract regions, where thought must draw sharp outlines if it is to reach clearly defined positions. But the reader will also be led out of these arid concepts into concrete life. I am indeed fully convinced that one must raise oneself into the ethereal realm of concepts if one would experience every aspect of existence. Whoever appreciates only the pleasures of the senses is unacquainted with life's sweetest savors. The Oriental sages make their disciples live a life of renunciation and asceticism for years before they impart to them their own wisdom. The Western world no longer demands pious exercises and ascetic habits as a preparation for science, but it does require the willingness to withdraw oneself a while from the immediate impressions of life, and to betake oneself into the realm of pure thought. The realms of life are many. For each one, special sciences develop. But life itself is a unity, and the more deeply the sciences try to penetrate into their separate realms, the more they withdraw themselves from the vision of the world as a living whole. There must be a knowledge which seeks, in the separate sciences, the elements for leading man back once more to the fullness of life. A scientific specialist seeks, through his findings, to develop awareness of the world and its workings. In this book, the aim is a philosophical one, that knowledge itself shall become organically alive. The separate sciences are stages on the way to that knowledge we are here trying to achieve. A similar relationship exists in the arts. The composer works on the basis of the theory of composition. This theory is a collection of rules which one has to know in order to compose. In composing, the rules of the theory become the servants of life itself, of reality. In exactly the same sense, philosophy is an art. All real philosophers have been artists in the realm of concepts. For them, human ideas were their artists' materials, and scientific method, their artistic technique. Abstract thinking thus takes on concrete, individual life. The ideas become powerful forces in life. Then we do not merely have knowledge about things, but have made knowledge into a real self-governing organism. Our actual working consciousness has risen beyond a mere passive reception of truths. How philosophy as an art is related to human freedom, what freedom is, and whether we do or can participate in it, this is the main theme of my book. All other scientific discussions are included only because they ultimately throw light on these questions, which are, in my opinion, the most immediate concern of mankind. These pages offer a philosophy of freedom. All science would be nothing but the satisfaction of idle curiosity, did it not strive to raise the value of existence for the personality of man. The sciences attain their true value only by showing the human significance of their results. The ultimate aim of the individual can never be the cultivation of a single faculty, but only the development of all the capacities that slumber within us. Knowledge has value only insofar as it contributes to the all-round development of the whole nature of man. This book, therefore, conceives the relationship between science and life, not in such a way that man must bow down before an idea and devote his powers to its service, but in the sense that he masters the world of ideas in order to use them for his human aims, which transcend those of mere science. One must be able to confront an idea and experience it, otherwise one will fall into its bondage. And that is the end of the section on prefaces. We will begin with Section 1, Knowledge of Freedom, Chapter 1, Conscious Human Action, next.